Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios, New York City. Today, we have a lot to share on a lot of different topics. First, of course, on health and nutrition. If you have Epstein-Barr virus, I've got good information for you. If you have Lyme's disease, I've got really good information for you. We're also going to talk about why vitamin D affirms, in the latest literature search, reduced risk of premature death from all causes. And, of course, many of you were concerned that the Wall Street Journal ran an opinion piece by Dr. Poe Offit against the vaccine skeptics. Well, we're going to respond. Richard Gale, senior scholar in residence, Paul Fitz Wall Street Journal cover up the truth behind infectious disease rates. We'll deal with that. My guest in the second part of our program will be Matthew Stein. He'll be talking about America's unpreparedness for severe solar storms, utility and federal agency cover-ups of previous efforts to help address our decrepit, very old power grids, and how we have virtually no protection if we get hit with a big storm. But you think, well, we haven't been hit with a big storm, so why worry? Yes, we have, and we just missed some very big ones. But we'll tell you about the storms that hit, and they were attributed to other problems around the world. Also, laughter is shown to work better than pharmaceuticals and affects the body like exercise. Very good article from Prevent Disease. Then we're going to have a challenge to Dr. Paul Offit in the Wall Street Journal with Dr. Susanna Humphreys on vaccinations. So as you see, we have a lot to share. If time permits, I'll take calls, but let's begin. First off, one more reason to appreciate the benefits of vitamin C. Now, of course, there are many ways of taking vitamin C. Last evening, I went up to get a late-night smoothie. Generally, I take berries because they're low in natural sugars and therefore won't keep you awake late at night. But they're really good because they give that super powerful polyphenol boost to the body. In other words, your fruits help repair damage to the DNA. Vegetables and greens help cleanse and are very good for rejuvenation. So I was taking a smoothie and a woman came over, wanted to ask me a question. Turns out she is like so many of the people now on the Upper West Side and that are getting food and juices late at night, generally associated with academia. Columbia University, she is a professor at Barnard, as well as another professor from Hunter was there. So we had this conversation about vitamins, especially vitamin C. And I suggested that when you take vitamin C that is not a quality vitamin C, you might take 500 milligrams and get an upset stomach. And you'll think you've reached bowel tolerance, meaning as much vitamin C as the body can handle. It's not true. You've hit acid reflux, meaning you have so much ascorbic acid hitting hydrochloric acid in the stomach that it causes some distress. However, if you took a buffered form of vitamin C and you put the vitamin C into a smoothie, then you can take sometimes 200 or 300% more because it's being buffered and gotten into digestion much better. What she wasn't aware of that. Something as simple as take your vitamin C with a meal. Preferably take a large amount in the morning in your smoothie and a large amount in the evening in a smoothie, and you'll find that it's easier to absorb, utilize, no distress. In any case, the newest amount of information is from Medical Science Monitor, and they showed a very high benefit when you get vitamin C for Epstein-Barr virus. and Epstein-Barr virus, which has been implicated in chronic fatigue syndrome, and Burkitt's lymphoma, and Hodgkin's disease, and some autoimmune diseases. Quote, this is, to our knowledge, the first clinical study of ascorbic acid and Epstein-Barr virus infections. And they evaluated men and women with chronic fatigue or other conditions who had Epstein-Barr virus, and they gave them up to 50 grams, that's 50,000 milligrams, intravenous vitamin C, and they showed remarkable improvements. Now, at first, it wasn't the first study. I did the first study at the Tri-State Healing Center in 1991 with a group of individuals who had chronic fatigue syndrome and Epstein-Barr virus. The titers were taken every day, and we had two groups, one that received vitamin C, and it was 75,000 milligrams once a week, and another group that received it 4 days a week, 75,000 milligrams. The difference was tremendous. What was interesting is that about one-third of the people who were in the study also had age-defining illnesses, and those conditions improved remarkably. And then we just continued on after that. It was a one-month study. And with the people with full-blown AIDS, we continued for 16 months. And in 12, the individuals completely reversed all AIDS-defining illnesses, including reversing it from HIV-positive, HIV-negative on all blood tests. And the blood tests were taken at a highly respected medical lab, Ben Diner and Schlesinger, outside. So we had independent blood confirmations of the viral loads, and we knocked out Epstein-Barr virus and chronic fatigue syndrome. And by the way, I would do the same identical protocol for people suffering from Lyme's disease, but I'll get into that in more depth a little later. A new study also shows that fasting regenerates the immune system. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Cell Stem Cell and done at the University of Southern California, which found that rejuvenating effects for fasting on immune system cells. Quote, what we started noticing in both our human work and animal work is that the white blood cell count goes down with prolonged fasting. Then when we refed, the blood cells come back. And it showed a remarkable improvement in enzymes and in immune modulation. So the takeaway message is this. If you were to take, let's say, one day a week, and only have liquids. Now, you could have your protein shake, you could have all your berries, fibers, but it's in liquid form. And then throughout the day, drink juices. That qualifies as a liquid fast for a day. And if you just got in the habit of doing that one day a week, that could make an enormous difference for your immune system. Bad news for the Center for Disease Control's announcement that diabetes is continuing to rise, with 30 million Americans having full-blown diabetes, but a huge number having prediabetes conditions. And that is not good. We're also seeing a resurgence in diabetes numbers in children. Now, of course, all this is completely preventable. When people are stressed, when they're depressed, when they're anxious, they frequently rely upon comfort foods. Now, depending upon what they used growing up for their relief of anxiety, and generally it's something soft and sweet, they'll rely upon it. But also, when people are highly anxious, they can't stop eating, even when they're full, even when they're stuffed. You get someone who's really anxious, and you might see this around a sporting event. A person's had a meal, and then on comes the ball game, and because of nervous excitement about the game, they begin to eat and drink. And they don't have the capacity at that point to shut off the mechanism that says, hey, you don't need any more food, you're full. And that leads to excess calories, and that leads to diabetes. A review published in the American Journal of Public Health shows that vitamin D levels are associated with a reduced risk of premature death. They looked at 32 different studies with over 566,000 men and women for their analysis, and they found that just moderate amounts of vitamin D extends the life from all causes. So get your vitamin D. Also, there's a whole campaign going on now to attack supplements. First, they said they were dangerous, but we proved they were not. And we did all the research, and even the government's own agency showed they're not. Drugs, medications, yes, they're dangerous. They're major killers, but not supplements. But then they started saying we didn't need them. Well, there's a 500,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature that we have that show, yes, we do need them, and these are quality, independent studies, as if these didn't exist. I imagine they're just guessing that legislators and physicians don't read anything. Well, they should. The good news is that Dr. Bruce Ames and Dr. Jeffrey Bloomberg wrote an article in the Annals of Internal Medicine in response to an editorial titled Enough is Enough, Stop Wasting Money on Vitamins and Mineral Supplements. The authors rebutted this, showing that there's a tremendous value to taking in the nutrients that people are doing. Now, of course, the people who wrote the article, Stop Wasting Money on Vitamins, are all affiliated with the pharmaceutical industry. Little surprise there that they would want us taking no more supplements but their drugs. There is a new article in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition showing that genistein, that I've spoken about many times in this program, that is found in soy, and we're talking about organic non-GMO soy, can help prevent prostate cancer metastasis. And that's really good. Quote, research conducted by the team and originally published in Clinical Experimental Metastasis as well as Molecular Pharmacology demonstrated that genistein dose-dependently inhibited human prostate cancer cell detachment, which is due to the isoflavones' ability to increase cell adhesion. In further research, the group implanted human prostate cancer cells observed that cellular adhesion increased with the administration of genistein. This was accomplished at plasma genistein levels similar to those measured in men at 150 milligrams a day of genistein, indicating that the compound inhibits cell detachment at concentrations attainable by humans. In lay language, when you take in genistein, which you can get, it's in a lot of supplements, at 150 milligrams a day, it's helping prevent the metastasis of prostate cancer to other parts of the body. Vitamin D insufficiency associated with HIV progression from the Journal of Infectious Disease reported findings from a major study. Those who were low in vitamin D had an increase in their progression. Well, this has been known for a long time. This is not new. That's why in all the people with AIDS-defining illnesses that I work with, vitamin D is one of the very first nutrients, along with a lot of others, that they take every day. But it's good to see that mainstream medicine is catching up. And finally, laughter is shown to work better than pharmaceuticals and affects the body like exercise. This is for prevent disease. It's really good piece. Now, all of the people in this audience, you know that there's no secret that laughter is good for you. Even when indulged in regularly, people sometimes get too serious and they forget about the importance of laughter. And laughter is a simple stress reducer, kind of natural Valium, but it also allows us to connect other people in such unique ways that it cannot be duplicated through any other method. A body of evidence shows that laughing not only works better than medication, but stimulates hormone levels in ways similar to exercise. One pioneer in laughter research was William Fry. He claimed it took 10 minutes on a rowing machine for his heart rate to reach the level it would after just 1 minute of hearty laughter. But he wasn't kidding. Norman Cousins, who I knew and interviewed many times, first suggested the idea that humor and the associated laughter can benefit a person's health. That was back in the mid-1970s. And as a layperson, he had no medical background, but he had been diagnosed with an autoimmune disease. And he documented his use of laughter in treating himself. And with medical approval and oversight, he went right into remission. Now, he published his personal research results in the New England Journal of Medicine and is considered one of the original architects of mind-body medicine. And Dr. Lee S. Burke, a preventative care specialist and psychoimmunology researcher at Louisiana University School of Allied Health and Medicine and director of the Molecular Research Lab at Loma Linda, as well as a Dr. Stanley Tan, have picked up where Cousins left off. And since the 1980s, they've been studying the human body's response to laughing and have found that laughter helps optimize many functions in body systems. And for example, laughter can optimize hormones in the endocrine system, including lowering the levels of cortisol and epinephrine, which lead to stress reduction. They've also shown that laughter has a positive effect on modulating your immune system, including increasing production of antibodies, activation of the body's protective cells, including T cells, and natural killer cell activity of tumor cells. And this is very, very positive. Now, the physiological study of laughter has a name. It's called gelotology. And that there are actually researchers who study humor and laughter and how they have an impact on the brain. And consider a recent study at Loma Linda University, which involved diabetic patients who had high cholesterol and high blood pressure. One group of participants received standard pharmaceutical treatment for these conditions. A second group was instructed to view selected humor. For instance, watch sitcoms or videos that they felt were funny for 30 minutes a day. After 1 year, in the laughter group, the good HDL cholesterol increased by 26%. The blood levels of C-reactive protein, a marker of inflammation, decreased by 66%. In the other group, the HDL increased by just 3%, and the C-reactive protein declined only by 26%. Quote, "We are finding to a certain extent that laughter exceeds many of the physiological benefits of several medications," end quote, Dr. Raymond Jeffrey. In another study, a group of healthy volunteers were recruited to a three-week study to examine the effects of laughter and distress on modulating the key hormones that control appetite. And during the study, each subject was required to watch one 20-minute video at random that was either distressful or humorous in nature. When they compared the hormone levels of pre- and post-viewing, they found that the volunteers who watched the distressing video showed no change in their appetite hormones. In contrast, the subjects who watched the humorous video had substantial changes in blood pressure and leptin and other levels in appetite. Specifically, the level of leptin, L-E-P-T-I-N, decreased, and that's very beneficial. So there's a lot of other ways also. It improves our blood flow, it improves immune response, it improves our blood sugar level, and allows us to be better relaxed at night. That's the latest on health and nutrition. Now we're going to take a quick break, come back, and we're going to go right in to Dr. Suzanne Humphreys talking about vaccinations. Please stay with us.
I have been studying vaccines for the past 3 years of my life when it came up in my professional life. And my current opinion about vaccinations is that they have never been safe. Never has there been a safe vaccine. Never will there be a safe vaccine. And it is not possible to have a safe vaccine. The reasoning for that is that the actual process of vaccination defies the natural function of the immune system. of living beings. It thwarts the immune system into a balance that's very unnatural and that leaves it susceptible to more things than just what you've maybe vaccinated supposedly for. Putting a disease matter into a body and thinking that the manner of which it's going in, i.e. usually through a muscle, through the skin, using a very unnatural thing, a needle, combined with all the chemicals and antibiotics and things that the manufacturing companies may not even know about at the time that they're being injected into a muscle, there's no possible way that that can be safe. Now, when you're bypassing the normal immune system by putting this disease matter into a muscle, you are stimulating yet another abnormal response at the site of the injection, pooling of all sorts of metals and things that call in the immune cells in this very unnatural way. And the result that these manufacturers or designers of vaccines often look for is simply an antibody, which is one small thing in the cascade of immunity that is so incredibly elegant they probably cannot appreciate, obviously don't appreciate, if calling a simple antibody, which is highly unpredictable, immunity, is insanity. If indeed it is such a miraculous product, wouldn't we be noticing how miraculous it is? Are they saying that we are just too stupid to notice that this is killing people and maiming people, that we're too stupid to notice that it's miraculous? You know, I think that is a lot of the argument. We're just too stupid to notice how miraculous this is. So to protect everybody, they're going to give it to us anyway. Why must such a wonderful product be forced upon people since the beginning of vaccination? If people were really seeing each other dropping dead of smallpox and they were really seeing each other being saved by a smallpox vaccine, the line would be out of town, you know, to get it. That's never been the case. The history books really show that the people that were vaccinated were among the sickest, that many children were dying after smallpox vaccinations, that they were developing terrible ulcerations, beautiful, perfect babies, you know, forced into smallpox vaccines, either dying or developing terrible, terrible diseases. And the diseases are often said, oh, that would have happened anyway. But parents who watch this happen time and again know otherwise. So those of us who actually notice the science is not backing up vaccination, those of us who notice that people are being maimed and killed by vaccinations, those of us who have experienced our own vaccine reactions are categorically thought to be mad, despite the fact that we've actually studied it. You know, none of my colleagues in the past studied vaccines, yet they still would think that the sound bites that they heard over and over and over the years about vaccines being safe and effective trumped any book knowledge that I may have attained and tried to discuss with them. It's baffling. It's like the minds have been sucked into this paradigm so deeply, and it's not just the minds of these doctors, but it's the safety net, and it's the comfort zone, and it's the rewards that they're getting as a result of all they're doing. And the rewards are not watching people get healthy. The rewards are monetary and the rewards are power. That's it. It's money and it's power. Many of the vaccine enthusiast doctors will parrot the phrase that babies need to be vaccinated when they're young because the take rate is better for the vaccine. Parents are being told to bring their 2-month, 4-month, 6-month-old infants in to have them injected with some 24 different disease matter injections, complete with the polysorbate 80, amounts of aluminum that are absolutely unsafe with the amount of body weight they're being injected into, which, by the way, is to generate the immune response that's desired. That's what the aluminum is there for. They're being told to bring these children in, and the real reason is because they need to get them there at 1 year. They need to train the parents. So to train the parents, they're injecting these children. I mean, how sick is this? If it's only to train the parents, then why not just give them a saline injection at 2, 4, and 6 months and let's just keep it to ourselves? Why do we have to inject disease matter that won't be effective and that will be problematic at 2, 4, and 6 months? An infant's immune system develops slowly. That's normal. It's part of the design. There are certain interleukins and TNFs, which are other kinds of immune cell secreted chemicals that fire up our immune system, that are specifically by nature blunted in a newborn. Vaccine scientists have been working on developing a way to rev those chemicals up because they think nature is flawed, because they think Mother Nature got it all wrong when designing the immune system of an infant, that Mother Nature had no idea how to create a human being that could fight off its own diseases while it was an infant and as it was growing. These immune chemicals that are not secreted at high levels for an infant are done so purposefully so that the immune system can develop slowly and, I'll say, thoughtfully, because the immune system does have a mind of its own. So it has to be able to respond correctly, react correctly, give feedback correctly. It is essentially like a mind in that sense. So why aren't these children all dying? Why are they not extremely vulnerable to disease, more so than the vaccine enthusiasts actually say they are, is because of breast milk. It's because of breast milk from a healthy mother who's eating a good diet. This is the design. You know, the design is to have these chemicals at a low level in an immature infant being supplemented by mother's milk. That's it. It's worked for a really long time. It works very well. And what that produces is an immune system that is highly competent in later years. And it puts forward an immune system that is still competent, even in a world full of bacteria, encapsulated bacteria that would require these responses in us, because the mother is able to essentially protect the baby with antibody through breast milk. So the inventors of vaccines have chosen a belief system whereby infants are all born with inadequate immune systems, and that the only way they can be saved from hepatitis B, rotavirus, et cetera, the infant vaccines, that the only way they can be saved from these diseases is getting vaccines into them as quickly as possible in multiple injections. So why do we need multiple injections? Well, they need multiple injections basically because these vaccines don't cause the immune response after one injection that would ultimately be desired by vaccine designers, or maybe not, because each vaccine actually has its own charge that goes with it, the amount of money that it's worth and that is charged for the administration. So the more vaccines given, the more money generated. But also the fact of the matter is that these young babies have a blunted immune response compared to you or I. And that's one of the reasons why the aluminum is added to the vaccines, is to stimulate that immune response by pooling aluminum into the muscle and calling forth immune cells to react to it, which is an absolutely unnatural thing. So what happens when babies are given a vaccine is that this normal non-reactivity of the immune system is abolished. And the non-reactivity then becomes hyper-reactivity, and that's why we're seeing so much asthma, so much reactive airway disease, allergies to peanuts and so on and so forth, latex. It's because of these injections that these young children are getting, not only that have the disease matter in them, but that have provoked the immune system in an unnatural way, shifting the normal balance of non-reactivity into one of hyper-reactivity. I think the reason that many people don't trust their own immune systems is because they've been conditioned to not trust it. They've never been given the opportunity to actually get sick and recover without an allopathic intervention. And because when they do get sick, they're given acetaminophen, ibuprofen, antibiotics, antivirals. And guess what? When you put those things into somebody who's sick, you'll make them sicker. But the person that's sick may think that the illness that they had just got worse. They're not going to think that the drugs that they took, how I can't convince people that the drugs that they've taken made them sicker and that they wouldn't have just gotten sicker anyway. It's very difficult because of the belief systems people have and what's on the shelves in the stores and what's being advertised on television, helping them with the beautiful pictures and the healthy people that are used in these ads. And then you have a doctor standing there with a degree who's gone through all this training and education saying, your own immune system isn't enough to fight this. That's because the doctor doesn't know how to take care of an immune system, because the doctor was never taught in medical school how to take care of an immune system. So what you end up with is a whole society from start to finish that doesn't know how an immune system works, that doesn't know how to take care of it, doesn't know how to replenish the nutrients and minerals that are needed, does not know how to ingest a diet that will support it, and then when it fails, it's God's fault. We need a vaccine. You know, it just wasn't designed properly. Or, you know,
That was Dr. Suzanne Humphreys. This is a response to Paul Offit's Wall Street Journal cover-up of the truth behind infectious disease rates. This is a rebuttal from Richard Gale. Let me quote it. In the wake of the CDC whistleblower, Dr. William Thompson, coming forth with documents and official confirmation about the CDC's cover-up of clinical trial data showing an association between the MMR vaccine and higher rates of autism among African-American boys, government officials have only one hitman to call upon for damage control, High Priest of the Church of Holy Vaccine, Dr. Paul Offit. Dr. Offit's recent op-ed in the Wall Street Journal is a typical propaganda piece that we have seen recycled repeatedly by opponents of parents who make the educated decision to withhold vaccination of their children. His essays regurgitates the now all-too-familiar litany of statistics of infectious disease rates to convince vaccine skeptics to vaccinate immediately. We are treated with figures of the growing number of cases of whooping cough, measles, and mumps in recent years, and then the charge of irresponsibility and blame placed upon the equally growing number of unvaccinated children. There is nothing new in Offit's Wall Street Journal screed. We have heard this all before. Moreover, what is always lacking for Mr. Offit and his ilk and media puffery are the actual details behind their off-handed claims. Without taking a deeper look into the actual biological causes for the recent increase in infectious outbreaks, Offit's list of numbers might be a convincing argument to persuade parents to vaccinate their children. However, by withholding the critical information necessary to come to a sound judgment as whether to vaccinate or not vaccinate, Offit's op-ed is nothing more than a fear-mongering and media misinformation piece. Indeed, 2010 witnessed a large upsurge in pertussis cases in California. That is correct. How many of these cases represent unvaccinated children? Ah, there is the dig. According to a survey conducted by Kaiser Permanente Medical Center in San Rafael, California, 81% of the patients surveyed were fully vaccinated with a complete series of shots. 11% had received at least one vaccination, leaving only a tiny 8% unvaccinated. Yet more recent figures during the 2014 whooping cough outbreak should have Offit and his friends at the CDC holding their water. Health officials in San Diego County, where 621 cases of pertussis were confirmed as of June, found that 85% were fully vaccinated, 11% were partially immunized, the remaining 4% were either unvaccinated or unknown. This month, Los Angeles County reported that only 8% of pertussis cases were among the unvaccinated. County health officials stated this low number of unvaccinated persons, quote, is not a significant factor in the spread of pertussis. Paul Offit swallowed that. Well, in 2012, Vermont had one of its largest pertussis increases. Here again, 90% of cases were among the fully vaccinated. A similar analysis can be performed on the failure of the mumps vaccine and the high rate of mumps infection among fully vaccinated people. Does this mean that the pertussis vaccine is now ineffective, or there is perhaps something more threatening and urgent that Offit is ignoring? Although Offit's Wall Street Journal article fails to mention waning efficacy of the vaccine, his support of the current health policy and the private vaccine industry, and the global vaccine giant Merck pays off it royally as the sponsor of his $1 million a year chair at the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. But when is that ever brought up? When was the last time Paul Offit told how many tens of millions of dollars that he could have received or did receive from royalties on patents he holds on vaccines, and how much he earns for speaking engagements sponsored by vaccine makers? Why is this never in any of the interviews? In 2013, an FDA study discovered that vaccinated baboons continue to carry the pertussis virus and will spread it to other animals. The World Health Organization openly admitted that the pertussis vaccine no longer works and is urging the development of a new vaccine to replace the ones currently in use. The same year, the CDC, since the pertussis vaccine, along with the flu and mumps vaccine, are the least effective, it means that large segments of the population, although vaccinated, fully vaccinated, are not protected, they're not immunized. Yet there is now evidence that rather than the pertussis vaccine offering at least some beneficial immunization for at least some of the vaccinated population, it might actually be the cause of far more dangerous threat from whooping cough infections. The U.S. is now the only nation witnessing high rates of whooping cough infection among fully vaccinated populations. Australia observed steady increases in pertussis infections reaching 80% and highly consistently for several years. Earlier this year, researchers at the University of New South Wales School of Biotechnology and Biomolecular Sciences announced their identification of the anomaly in the new pertussis genotype, making the virus immune to vaccines on the market. In 2012, the university reported, quote, the genotype was responsible for 31% of the cases in the 10 years before the epidemic, and that has now jumped 84%, a nearly 300% increase, indicating that it has gained a selective advantage under the current vaccination regime, end quote. The university's April 14th press release states, quote, the bacterium that causes whooping cough, pertussis, has changed most likely in response to the vaccine used to prevent the disease, with the possible reduced effectiveness of the vaccine as a result, end quote. The researchers suspect that over-vaccination against pertussis infection has triggered the emergence of a new pertussis strain. In recent years, health officials in Finland, France, Japan, and the Netherlands have also reported a new pertussis strain affecting fully vaccinated populations. And what is not being reported by the state and county health officials are the percentages of whooping cough cases due to the new viral strain. Nevertheless, the rates of infection among the vaccinated population are very consistent with those reported by other nations. In February 2013, the CDC finally came out with its announcement in the New England Journal of Medicine that the new strain was affecting Americans. Unlike other nations, health officials, the CDC ignores making any reference to the pertussis epidemic occurring primarily among the fully vaccinated. Moreover, there is no reason to believe that the CDC didn't have prior knowledge of the new virus on America's shore years earlier. Always slow to report and exceedingly conniving to manipulate data and engage in cover-ups and lies, the research to advance its vaccination campaigns and propaganda. Dr. Thompson, revelations that the CDC should persuade us that nothing regarding vaccines coming out of the agency should be entertained without deep suspicion. There is good reason to believe that the present pertussis vaccines are the leading culprit for recent whooping cough outbreaks. Bacterial resistance to antibiotics is an earlier precedent of organisms adapting to modern medical intervention. Why wouldn't viruses do the same? But this kind of rationale is absent from Offit's limited and determinist vaccine ideology, who has now created a pseudoscientific mythology and screed to accuse parents who don't vaccinate their children for recent whooping cough outbreaks to benefit the profiteers in the vaccine industry. We'll be taking a break in a moment, coming back with our guest. But first, I have something brand new to offer you. If you're watching, and you can go to easy to watch Ustream channel TV, just ustream.tv and look for Gary Noll, you'll see I'm holding a beautiful hardback book, a big book. It's It's beautiful hardback. It's new. It's called No More Allergies, A Complete Guide to Preventing, Treating, and Overcoming Allergies. And in this, I have every possible holistic model for overcoming. I have the allergy, No More Allergy diet with juices, breakfast, soup, salads, dressings, entrees, desserts, a 21-day No More Allergy program. I have a resort guide for building your immune system, and I have every nutrient you need for allergens. I have all the different causes of allergies, from chemical sensitivities, fluoride, formaldehyde, pesticides, radon, volatile organic chemicals. They're all listed in what they do in the body, in every way that you can help yourself. So this is a big new book, and that's part of it. The other one is a new documentary I have called No More Allergies. In fact, it's on a lot of public television stations right now. And in here, I go to everything you need to do by the leading medical doctors. I have, I think, 12 of them in here showing you what to do if you have allergens. So the two go together. No More Allergies, the documentary, and No More Allergies, the hardback book. Recipes, programs, protocols. If you were to come into my office, the advice I would give you would be in this book plus a lot more. Here's the deal. It's a great special. You're able to get the book and video, which normally would go for $65 for $49.95. That's it. And we have a limited number of books. We purchased them here, so you don't have to contact the publisher. Call this number, 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. The special will be in effect for 2 days because of the number of books that we ordered. We ordered a couple hundred books. So 877-627-5065 for the brand new book, No More Allergies, and the current documentary, No More Allergies. You get the book and the documentary together, and we'll get it out within the next day or two to you. Finally, for those of you who have not yet received your green stuff because you didn't think you needed it, well, think again. Green stuff is a phenomenally powerful, all-inclusive whole food. It is raw. It comes in a powder. It's 500 grams. It is 20 vegetables and phytonutrients. It's got the great organic kale and barley grass. It's got oat beta-glucan and split pea protein. It has apple pectin and carrots, chicory, cabbage, broccoli, spirulina, parsley, celery, collard greens, kale, spinach, cauliflower, chlorella, arugula, asparagus, onion, and radish. Has a natural cherry and natural pineapple flavor, and that's it. It's juiced, it's vegan, it's non-GMO, it's gluten-free, its ORAC value is 10,000 per serving of ORAC, the protective antioxidants. This has got it all. I mean, this is still the number one selected, all-inclusive green powder. My ingredients are not grown in China. You ought to check where some of the other ingredients are. So we go to great detail to provide the finest quality, the dried from fresh vegetables and whole foods. It's raw, it's organic, and it's on sale also. So you're going to get this on sale as well. They got a great price for you. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. So we have two specials today. You can get No More Allergies, the book, and the documentary, the hardback book, by the way. And that's a good one. You're saving a good amount of money there. Or you can get green stuff, the month supply. Again, great prices. 877-627-5065. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. I fell asleep late last night, and I dreamed that the night and almost half the day away. I just got up so that I could hear her say she's still in love, and no one could take her love away. Ooh, love wakes me up every day, and I thought no one could ever make me feel this way. Nice to have you with us, everyone. Let's go out to Truckee, California. Standing by is Matthew Stein, an engineer with a degree in mechanical engineering from MIT and a National Merit Scholar. He is also the author of a very important work that is now the standard in the field about when disaster strikes, a comprehensive guide to emergency planning and crisis survival. His website is whentechfails.com. We're going to talk about America's unpreparedness for severe solar storms, utility and federal agency cover-ups, and what we can do about it. Nice to have you with us, Matthew.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me back on, Gary.
Matthew, first, let's talk about a review of the Oak Ridge National Laboratory that predicted the extent of the cost of life and electrical shutdown in the event of a major severe solar storm. And to your knowledge, what happened to this report?
Well, after the federal EMP, bipartisan EMP commission, identified both EMP, which is a nuclear terrorist attack where they blow a device off well above the surface of the Earth and cause an electromagnetic pulse that wipes out electricity and electrical systems in the planet or in the affected area, and natural EMP that some call, or an extreme solar storm, they identified this as an event that's quite likely and that we need to do something about it. So they sponsored Oak Ridge National Labs and Department of Homeland Security sponsored a study done by Meditech Corporation where they simulated the effect on our grid of a massive solar storm equal to the solar storm of 1921, which is just 90 years ago, and there was an even stronger one 60 years before that. So these are things that scientists estimate is a one. Basically, we have a 1 in 8 chance every decade. So it's been 9 decades from the last one. So we're living on borrowed time. And what they found was that the simulated response to the grid was that it would wipe out something like 370 massive transformers that keep our grid interconnected and running. Now, people think, like, well, you know, what happens if a big transformer gets wiped out? You know, you go out to your hardware store, you buy another. It's like, no. These are custom-made. They're tens of millions of dollars each. They're 100 tons each. You have to shut down a freeway to deliver them. In the best of times, there's a one-year delivery to get a single transformer replaced. And in current days, because of the ramping up of the grid in China and India, there's a 3-year waiting list to get one. So what they're looking at is our world totally depends on the grid. Now, back in 2003, we had some trees that shorted out power lines in the East Coast, and it caused a cascading failure to 50 million people. Now, this is not a terrorist act. This is not a massive solar storm destroying 370 heat giant, you know, irreplaceable transformers. This was just some trees shorting some power lines out, causing a cascading failure. So you can imagine what it would do to us if 370 of these things are fried in a single incident, and it would cause total collapse and chaos throughout most of North America. You know, you're talking about no power, no internet, no refrigeration, no oil refining, no oil pumping, no national security, no stock market, nothing. I mean,
no food and no drink of clean water.
Yeah, typically we work on just-in-time delivery now. You know, when I was a kid and you were a kid, there was an average of a month's worth of critical supplies in every major metro area in warehouses in and around the metro area. Now what you're eating on what you buy in the store on Friday was probably on a truck coming somewhere across the country on Monday. So there's essentially a 3-day supply on hand at all times in all metro areas. So, and you know, when things go down, you know, then there's chaos. I mean, for one thing, you won't be able to buy anything because there will be no electricity, no money machine cards running, no bank machines, no cash registers won't even open. I mean, you know, so.
And you're not going to be able to drive anywhere to get anything because everything's going to be one giant traffic jam. People will wreck, people run out of gas. Now, I want to look at a different part of this, though.
Okay.
The solar storm standard was written by a group, a private corporation, not the federal government, called the North American Electric Reliability Corporation. and they're the ones downplaying this severity.
That's correct.
Who are they, and why are they? What's their motive?
Well, North American Electric Reliability Corporation was an industry trade association, and basically back in, you know, Congress was concerned about the reliability and people after the 2003 blackout. So basically, the people were saying, "Hey, let's get some better. You know, let's look at our grid reliability more carefully. Let's get some government jurisdiction over this." And then industry was pressuring them the other way, and so they sort of caved. They basically said that North American Electric Reliability Council, this private trade organization, was converted into a self-regulatory organization with the power both to set and enforce grid standards. So recently, with the concern over solar storms, they went, you know, FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, went to NERC, the private commission, and said, "Could you guys write us a solar storm reliability protocol?" They said, "Sure, we'll be happy to." And so they wrote a protocol, and it basically says that, you know, this is the standard when there's a giant solar storm coming, you know, this is the procedure to do. Well, the problem is that it's a feel-good, do-nothing standard that basically says everybody has to be trained in this standard, but it's not telling the utilities to actually put any hardware in to protect our grid. So, for example, in 1989, there was a huge solar storm by modern standards, big solar storm, but it was only one-tenth as strong as the 1921 storm. The 1921 storm is the one in every 80 years. It's been 90 years, you know, so it's, you know, it's a statistical average. There could be two of those 5 years apart, and there could be 200 years apart. But, you know, there was one 90 years ago, and there was one 60 years before that. So the statistical average says that we're due for another big one. So this 1989 storm, which was big by modern standards, but by historical standards was not that big. You know, one-tenth as strong as 1921, which is 50% as strong as the 1859. So what happened in 1989? Well, in the first 30 seconds of the 1989 storm, the Quebec grid experienced 15 simultaneous failures, one of which was frying one of these massive transformers we're talking about, just a single massive transformer. In the same storm, one went down in the UK, one went down in the eastern coast of the United States, and both of those caused some power failures, significant power failures. And the one in Quebec, along with 15 other simultaneous failures, caused the whole province of Quebec to go down for, you know, much of a day. A couple of places, some of the places were down for 2 days. So the entire province was knocked out. Now, that's from a storm one-tenth as strong as the 1921 storm, 50% weaker than the 1859 storm. So the thought that you could make a paper standard and that people could somehow pull the standard out and follow it in the event of a solar storm, it's just preposterous when you think that it was in the first 30 seconds all of this happened in Quebec. How are people going to pull out a standard, make decisions, decide, "Oh, well, I think we're going to shut down the entire grid in the United States to protect these transformers"? It's like, no, it isn't going to happen. They're going to fry, and the long-term result is going to be life as we know it ending on, you know, in the United States for a very long time.
Okay, Matt, I don't want to run out of time, but I want to get some short yes-no answers from you, okay?
Okay.
Did Congress, the House of Representatives, voted unanimously to do something about this?
No. I mean, Congress has not voted. In other words, they have the SHIELD Act in Congress to force the private utilities to put hardware in place to protect us. And so far, they've never approved this.
But it hasn't been done. Hasn't been followed through.
Okay. It hasn't been done.
Are the utilities the main culprits, and they don't want to spend the money to upgrade the quality of the grid system?
Well, the problem is it's dual culprit. Congress worded the SHIELD Act so the utilities had to put money out of their own pocket. $2 billion is what it's going to take. Now, that's chump change for government, but it's a lot of money for the utilities. So what the utilities did was they had this conference. They came out with a report called the High Impact, Low Frequency Report. In other words, HILF report, saying that this is a black swan event. This could end life as we know it. This could be damaging and just collapse the United States. This is serious. Then when Congress sponsored this bill that said the utilities had to pay for this, the utilities basically fired the guys, the NERC, basically got rid of the guys who wrote the Hilf report saying what a big deal it was. They wrote a new report saying, don't worry, everything's okay, we have it under control. You know, our current safeguards are adequate, and they're going to protect us. So it was like, and I believe in Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy, too. I mean, it's the same corporation that sponsored the Hilf report and said it was a serious deal, 2 years later says, now it's not a big deal. When Congress asked them, well, what new studies did you do? They said, no, we didn't do anything. What new data do you have? We didn't do any. Well, they said, what about the Meditech study that, you know, Oak Ridge National Lab sponsored? And they said, well, it's proprietary computer code, so we can't really analyze it, but we talked amongst our members and we decided everything's going to be okay.
Okay, I need real short answers now, yes and no. Cost savings by corporations have taken precedent over consumer protection and safety across industries, big pharma, big ag, big oil, many others. Are we witnessing the same cost reduction versus safety from a solar storm with the electricity industry, yes or no?
Absolutely.
Okay. There are 2,000 electrical utility companies operating in the United States. 90% are exempt from solar storm standards. Therefore, if we should have a solar storm that is due, past due, these utilities are not prepared if the solar storm knocks out their power grids to turn electricity on by some other means, yes or no?
Yes.
Okay. That brings us to some of the... So we're not prepared for a solar storm, but there have been solar storms around the world in different locations, South Africa and Canada, in the last 10 years, have there not?
Yes.
Okay.
Huge one, South Africa, 14 transformers eventually failed. The entire country had to run for a year with rationed power. Imagine trying to work 2 or 3 days of your week, you have no power the entire day, no lights, no air conditioning, nothing.
Okay. Is it not also true that... that in the event of a major solar storm, that there would be, within 48 hours to maybe 3 days, there'd be no food available anywhere. You wouldn't be able to get water or gasoline or diesel out of any filling station. You wouldn't be able to get money. You wouldn't be able to go anyplace unless you had a bicycle, because every road's going to be blocked. You would have absolute total anarchy and chaos.
That's correct, 100%.
And that would be as applicable to the very wealthy as it would be the poor. People would be stuck where they are, which then by extension, you could be without any electricity as we know it from these down grids, because there'd be no way to manufacture the grid, because it requires electricity to manufacture the grid operators, products. And then you don't have clear highways to get these 100-ton to a location and to get them in place. So you're looking at possible 1 to 2 years without electricity. Is that a possibility?
That's correct. Parts of the country will be able to disconnect and restart, mostly rural places far away from big cities. If they have good local power generation, they'll be able to, you know, and smart engineers, they'll be able to cold restart. But bulk of the major metro areas will be down for months to years, many months to years.
Okay, well, if any major metropolitan area in the United States that has a nuclear power plant within 100 miles, which are most of the new major cities in the United States, that means that they do not have more than a maximum of 30 days backup fuel, if that, because it's not mandatory. It's a week to a month.
Correct.
And therefore, they will go Fukushima, because there won't be anything to cool the spent fuel rods.
Correct. Some plants may have really good operators that shut down the reactor, do the cost with their backup fuel they got, run generators, and unload them. But chances are quite slim that anyone will make that drastic a measure before it's too late.
And how in the world would they take the spent fuel rods, that they have far more spent fuel rods that are very dangerous outside the plant than the active fuel rods in the plant? Both require water for coolant. After the backup generators go off, where are they supposed to take these? There's no place for them to take them. There's no highway where they will be able to get the spent fuel rods loaded and get them to that location?
No, they have to go into fuel ponds, and fresh fuel rods will boil a fuel pond dry in 3 days' time if there's no fresh water pumps to bring water into the fuel pond. So boil dry in like 3 days. And
then you got Fukushima.
in 30 days if their old fuel rots. But with hot, brand new fuel rots, they'll boil dry in 3 days unless you can keep the water flowing in the ponds.
That means that you would have a major Fukushima meltdown at those facilities, which means the public wouldn't know it because there's no news.
That's correct.
They
no
would
news,
not-
no internet. You have 104 nuclear reactors in the country. You can assume that a significant portion of them will go Fukushima style after, you know, when they run out of fuel, backup fuel to run the generators, in with somewhere between a week and a month's time after a major EMP solar storm event.
Okay, which means that we could probably lose up to 100 million Americans dying within the first 14 to 16 months. This is why it's a serious issue. This is why we should pay attention. And yet of all the things making everyone's talking lists on media every day, this is not even in the thought process. Matthew, we're out of time. Thank you for bringing this to our attention once again. We should focus on it. Matthew Stein from Truckee, California. We're out of time. I'm Gary Knoll. I do have an article on this on our website that shows you what you could do. Hope that you take a careful attention to it. Have a nice day, everyone. Let's say hello to Eutrice Lead. Hi, Eutrice.
Hello, Gary. Today it's Free Your Mind Friday on Lead Stories, and listeners have their say.
Great. Eutrice Lead right now.
Program director is Jason Tabenfeldt. The archive team is Sharon Pride and Casey Holford. And our head engineer is Giselle Hernandez. You can download past programs by visiting our archives at prn.fm.